Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The State Arts Council is underway in Tulsa, began yesterday and continues through Thursday, and will today feature a special noontime presentation celebrating the 50th anniversary of two organizations that have injected millions of dollars into the arts and humanities here in the state. The National Endowment for the Arts Chair, Jane Chu, and the National Endowment for the Humanities Chairman, Dr. William Adams, will discuss the impact of their respective agencies on American culture. Dr. Adams is my guest today. William Adams is the 10th chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Before taking office as chairman, he served as the president of Colby College in Maine from the year 2000 through his retirement in 2014. He's had a long career in higher education, teaching at political philosophy at Santa Clara University, the University of North Carolina. Then he went on to coordinate the Great Works in Western Culture program at Stanford University. Later served as a vice president and secretary of Wesleyan University, and was president of Bucknell University in 1995 before moving to Colby College in 2000. I spoke with him yesterday from his office in Washington, D.C., about the impact of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Dr. William Adams is my guest today. Chairman Adams, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Congratulations on the NEH's 50th anniversary. I know you've been involved with a lot of 50th anniversary ceremonies over the last month or so. And, you know, I can remember a day and age when we might be surprised today that we have an NEH and NEA 50 years later because of the threats. Can you sum up the importance of the NEH over the last 50 years in American culture?
I certainly can, and will do so. I should say that in doing so, you have to work off the very complex array of grants and initiatives that we've been involved in across six of our major programs. You know, we give grants out for research, fundamental research in the humanities. We give grants for educational initiatives. We give grants for humanities in the public sphere, everything from documentaries to radio productions to now gaming of various kinds that supports educational institutions. We do a lot of very technical and important work in the space of cultural preservation and documentary preservation around the country. And we do wonderful work in helping humanities-based cultural institutions improve and increase their capacity to do the work that they do. But I think there are three or four fundamental points across all of that very complicated grant making. We are one of the most important agencies or institutions that helps the country preserve its cultural and historical legacy. And in doing that, we contribute to a much clearer picture of the United States in people's minds. We contribute to the preservation of the values and the principles of the United States, and we contribute very importantly to the preservation of democracy in this country. We do that by strengthening people's appreciation and understanding for American history, their understanding of the principles of liberal democracy, and their understandings of the complex cultural situation of the United States in this and previous eras. So I really think it's about basically strengthening people's appreciation for the deep cultural legacy of the United States and the importance of our history to an appreciation for the challenges that confront us in the present.
Now, I think one of the drawbacks perhaps the National Endowment for the Humanities has is because you work with a lot of different organizations. A lot of those organizations seem to be front and center. I'm thinking about when you talk about preserving heritage, I think a lot of people think of the National Park Service as being that sort of physical repository for American heritage. But what probably most people don't know is how hand in hand you work with the Park Service in actually doing the work of preservation.
Well, we do, and we work on our own independently of the Park Service. But take, for example, the museum community in Tulsa, the Gilcrease Museum, which has this fabulous collection of the American West. You know, we've done multiple grants with that and other museums in Oklahoma. In fact, something like 400 grants to Oklahoma organizations over that 50 years and something like $38 million in support just to Oklahoma. So a lot of that goes to the university and college community, but some of it goes to other places, including places like the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, which we've helped preserve records and artifacts. We've helped supported the digitization of thousands of pages of Oklahoma newspapers from 1860 to 1922 at the Muskogee Center and the Cheyenne Transporter by way of example. So we help institutions that are based in communities and are doing the work of cultural preservation. And, of course, they're doing the work. We're giving them the money, but the money is hugely important. The funding is hugely important to their ability to continue to operate at a high level.
When I was thinking of the Park Service, I was thinking about a National Endowment for the Humanities funded research, which helped found the original settlement fort that had been lost for centuries.
Well, we've done a lot of really fundamental preservation work like that, and we help historical associations and societies, for example, all over the country, including very important national historic sites like Jefferson's Monticello in Virginia, the home of James Madison, Montpelier. In those places and many others across the country, we have funded archaeological work, we've funded documentary work, we've funded programmatic work where the public gets exposed to the riches of those places. So we're out and about in thousands of different ways in communities all over the country doing this extremely important work. And of course, one of the really important communities we've served, particularly in Oklahoma, but all across the Southwest and the South, is the Native American groups that have a lot of cultural heritage to preserve in their own communities.
When we first started chatting, you mentioned something. I wanted to stop you when you said that, but I'll let you finish. But you mentioned gaming. How is the NEH involved in gaming, and what type of gaming are we talking about? Because around here, when we think of that, we think of casinos.
Now, I'm talking about digital gaming of the kind that young people are involved in all over the country.
Yeah.
And we support the development of games that have very focused educational purpose. For example, we're reviewing an application currently that has to do with a game that's being developed for students to understand the works of Henry David Thoreau and the great contribution he made to American culture. We've done work in New York helping development of games that teach young people about the immigrant communities there across the 19th century particularly. Well, we supported a game that was built around the smallpox epidemic in the 19th century, which teaches people about the history of public health challenges and the way in which those kinds of epidemics affected different groups of Americans at different times. So we really want to be current in terms of the educational assets that we're offering to teachers and to families to help convey the richness of American history and culture.
And you're going to be appearing here in Tulsa for the Oklahoma Arts Conference, and also you'll be joining with your sister agency, the head of the National Endowment for the Arts, to have a conversation about the 50th anniversary of both of these organizations. You're coming to a state, like many southern states, that are facing severe budget restraints, and we're looking at huge budget shortfalls in Oklahoma, and there are a number of other states in the South that are looking at similar situations. The arts, even though it's usually small contributions from the states, the arts and humanities, this is some of the first targets chosen. What do you see as the best effective defense for making a case for arts and humanities funding in a time of severe budget shortfalls?
Well, I should start by saying I'm very sympathetic to the pressures that have arisen across the country in varying ways in different places with respect to budgets and budget shortfalls. And I understand completely that hard choices have to be made. But we can't think about art and culture and history and all of those things associated with it as the icing on the cake, the frills that we can do without, because these things really have to do fundamentally with our identity and with who we are. So they're essential to the ways in which we actually live. I've said a lot publicly that the great challenges that we face as a country are really not technical challenges. They're not scientific challenges, though science creates some of the challenges that we're dealing with as it creates great opportunities. We're dealing with things that have to do with our culture, our ideas, our values, and our history. And we can't fail to invest in the understanding that citizens have of those places where most of the great questions of the age live. So I think it's short-sighted to leave behind the humanities and the arts. I also think it's terribly important for schools and colleges and universities of all kinds to remember that in the end, we're trying to educate whole people for whole lives, and we have to be committed to the arts and the humanities just as we have to be committed to the sciences and the technical disciplines, because we live in places where we need those things, all of us do, and where we have to operate as whole people with all of the skills and capacities that we need. One of the best examples, going back to what I said before, is the whole question of citizenship. We can't expect to have a robust democratic culture in this country without citizens who understand history, our fundamental political principles, and the way these principles have played out over time. It's just not possible. So if we care about democracy, and if we care about the imagination and the innovative spirit in the country, we can't cut ourselves off from the arts, and we can't cut ourselves off from the humanities.
Well, I ask you, how do you have those civic discussions on citizenship when basically the two polar opposites of the political spectrum can't even agree on what those definitions are? I mean, we have a fundamental disconnect on citizenship, nature of government, and a whole variety of questions. Can the NEH be a convener of debate on that, or what exactly?
I don't know that NEH can be a convener on the question. We can be both a symbol of and a funder of initiatives and projects in communities across the country that try to bring people together in civil ways to talk about, to discuss major problems that have, or major challenges that have, historical and cultural dimensions to them, which is most of them. So we can help, I think, by both symbolically and financially supporting those kinds of engagements as they occur around the country and to the best of our ability. I wish we had more resources with which to do that, but we have been doing some of that. We are doing some of that. We'll continue to do some of that. We do have a problem in the country. I think the problem in Washington is somewhat different from the problems we have elsewhere, but one of the things I worry about the most is the erosion of this value and ideal of citizenship and the erosion of the capacities that people have to be engaged citizens in the republic. If we lose a democratic culture, if we lose the value of citizenship, we're going to lose our democracy sooner or later.
What can the NEH do to combat that? I mean, is it up to individual organizations that NEH can fund, or what can NEH actually do?
Well, certainly our work and our funding can help advance projects, initiatives, and institutions across the country that have to do with democratic political life. We do fund projects at colleges and universities that have to do with that. We fund teachers' institutes around the country that have to do with that. We fund thousands of projects in history that help everybody understand our history better. So we are doing a lot. I think we all have to also, in NEH, has to speak up about this, as I do. Getting back to the schools, we have to continue to remind people that we can't narrow the scope of our educational ambitions for young people in this country. We have to be mindful that we're educating citizens every bit as much as we're educating workers and professionals. It's not enough to educate workers and professionals. We have to educate citizens, and that requires a set of educational commitments that I agree have come under pressure, but we have to remember their ultimate value.
My guest today is William Adams, chairman of the National Endowment for Humanities. He's a former president of Colby College in Maine. He was there for 14 years and formerly taught at Stanford, University of North Carolina, and Santa Clara University. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa.
And I was also commissioned as a second lieutenant in the artillery at Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
So you spent a bit of time in Lawton, huh?
I spent a bit of time in Lawton, and that was a very important passage in my life.
If I can change our focus to the federal situation, the federal funding climate, we've talked about how difficult it is for states like Oklahoma, which are looking at substantial budget shortfalls. As you well know, the NEH and NEA have been under threat from certain quarters in Congress for a long time. The funding's been relatively stable, I think, over the past few years. Is it about, $148 million a
That's
year?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
How stable is funding for NEH today? I mean, I assume you're gauging the pulse of Congress. Is that still in? Is the agency still in the crosshairs of certain segments of Congress?
I meet with a lot of people in Congress to talk about NEH and NEA and the important work that we do. I have to say that I have not encountered a great deal of one-on-one opposition to the nature of our work. And to me, the climate has been fairly positive. Now, that said, I do understand, as I said before, all of the pressures that are on the federal government, but we do have some real issues to face in federal spending. But again, I go back to the question you posed earlier. It's very short-sighted to imagine that we can solve our problems by going after these small agencies, which do so much pound for pound for the country in the work they do. Symbolically, that would be very detrimental, I think, to the country. And it would be detrimental to the cultural sector that we serve. Over the 50 years that we've been in existence, we have given away, between the two agencies, NEA and NEH, almost $11 billion. That money has served communities, local communities, because it serves institutions all over the country. And to imagine that that work would have been done by somebody else is, I think, just a fantasy. It would not have been done by somebody else. So we would have a much smaller, less well-developed, and less impactful cultural community. And culture is a hugely important part of people's lives. So the country would be worse off, there's no question in my mind, and we won't be able to solve our problems financially, fiscally, by neglecting the cultural sphere. It's just not big enough financially, and we have much bigger problems than that to solve.
Well, I know here, at least in Oklahoma, the NEH has really picked up a lot of the slack for the State Council of Humanities, because I'm not for sure, but I think really the state funding is just about gone for the humanities. There's still some art funding, Arts Council funding, but I'm not sure that there's actually state funding for the humanities.
Yeah, I don't have the Oklahoma figures in front of me, but I know that our grant making has had a huge impact on Oklahoma. As I said, almost $40 million over the last 50 years. So that's been a very significant commitment, and it certainly would be noticed if it hadn't been there.
Let me ask you about, the National Endowment for the Humanities. I think people understand the National Endowment for the Arts. It's performing arts. It's visual art. The humanities is a more nebulous subject. You've spoken a lot about histories, but it's more than history. It's literature. It's a lot of different things. Can you maybe sort of share what the vision of the endowment is in supporting these particular parts of our culture and the breadth of that culture?
Yeah, there are two ways of talking about the humanities. One is to talk about the academic formations that compose the humanities, typically in colleges and universities, and that involves you in talking about history and literature, philosophy, archaeology, anthropology, linguistics, jurisprudence, all of those ways of parsing the humanities sphere in the academic world. A much better way to talk about it is by way of the things that pertain to our history, to our culture, our ideas, and our values. The humanities are about those things in one way or another all the time. So it has a huge amount to do with our cultural understanding and our cultural legacies, which have to do with many different things in this country, being as complicated a country as we are in the cultural sense. Everybody knows that we have a great and important history to tell. It's a history not just of the United States, it's a history of many or indeed most parts of the world now, with the U.S. as a world power. We have a rich tradition of philosophy and ideas, including the founding ideas that created our democracy at the Revolution in the 18th century. And we have a rich discussion and history of talking about values, what we ultimately care about. So the humanities are invested in all of those things, and I find it much more helpful to talk about those spheres of our lives, because that's where we all live, finally.
Well, give us a sense of your own background before coming to the NEH. You were president of Colby College, but before that you were sort of a political philosopher, I suppose. You looked at coordinating the Great Works and Western Culture program at Stanford. You've sort of been doing that same sort of work in your own private life.
Yes, I've had an interesting and varied career. I've spent a lot of time teaching in the university community. I've been a college administrator and a college president for almost 20 years before coming to NEH. I also have a military background, as I mentioned. I enlisted in 1966. I was commissioned in 1967 at Fort Sill. I served a year in Vietnam before leaving the Army in 1969. And that had a huge impact on me, and it made me want to study philosophy because I had lots of questions about the ultimate meaning of things. You know, I think the humanities, to some degree, are almost always come back to this question of meaning. What gives our lives meaning? How we make meaning in our lives and how we understand the meanings that others attach to their lives, most especially the way other cultures think about meaning. So the world of meaning, the making of meaning, is something that is very central in the humanities, and it's been central in my life as well.
Now, you're visiting Oklahoma for the Arts Conference. You'll be having a conversation. When you go out to a state, what are you wanting to learn about that state, which, of course, the NEH has so much of an effect? You're funding, you know, dozens of projects in each state. Are you wanting to know whether that money was well spent? What exactly are you trying to find out when you go out to a state to visit and to understand what's going on in the state?
One thing I am trying to find out is how our grant making has affected the communities in which those grants have been given. So I'm very interested in talking to grantees about how it's gone and what they learned as they did the work that we funded. I'm also really interested in the local culture of communities and states. Oklahoma is a very, you know, it's a very interesting and kind of unique place. I don't think there's anything else quite like it in the country. The important urban communities, Tulsa and Oklahoma City, are really interesting places. So I'm learning about the culture. I also like to learn about the history of the place if I can. And I'm always eager to talk to people about local and regional history. And I'm eager to get a sense of what the humanities are actually doing in places like Tulsa. You know, I want to know that what the museum community is doing. I want to know what the library community is doing. I want to know what the university and college community is doing. I want to know what's going on in high schools. Now, I can't do all of that in every visit, but those are the kinds of things I'm trying to pick up because they inform, in turn, my sense of the direction and future of NEH and how we should be shifting or changing our grant making.
Has that grant making changed in light of some challenging state environments around the country? The Great Recession's had a tremendous effect on a lot of states when it comes to arts and humanities funding.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And I'll give you two examples. We're about to announce an important change in our one of our programs where we're going to be helping graduate programs in the humanities at research universities across the country broaden the ways in which they're thinking about the professional futures and careers of their students. So we're going to incentivize them to think more broadly about where their graduates go, because there is a narrowing of the channels of employment in the humanities in the classical sense at colleges and universities. Another good example is where we want to start helping, being more helpful to colleges and universities who are thinking about their humanities curricula and how they organize courses, what kinds of courses they offer, to speak to today's issues and the changes, the evolutions in the way students and parents are thinking about things. So those are two good examples of consequences of visits that I've done and other people at the agency have done in understanding what's going on in the country. So it's very important for us to be out and about, and it's especially important for me to be out and about.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with the 50th anniversary of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts, and we look forward to your visit here in Tulsa.
Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. William Adams is the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. He and the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, Jane Chu, are in Tulsa for the State Arts Conference. To learn more about the endowment, visit neh.gov. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Janet Pearson.
Even before the weather starts to change, you notice it. What poet Emily Dickinson called that certain slant of light. A subtle but sure sign of seasonal transition. Even without a calendar to tell you it's time for the season to change, you can sense it's happening. On some primitive level, you can just feel it. You also feel it deep down inside on some primordial emotional level, too. What is it about the change of the season that makes human beings become reflective, philosophical, even a little melancholy at times? Why do we sometimes even want to resist the change? It's no wonder poets have always been drawn to the subject, although it's certain in most cases they weren't writing about just the change in seasons. Poor Emily Dickinson found that bright and peculiar new lighting on winter afternoons oppressive, like the heft of cathedral tunes. Robert Frost, in his poem Reluctance, thought it treasonous to the heart to go along with the end of a love or a season. Everyone's favorite romantic poets, Shelley and Keats, had field days with the coming of autumn. In Ode to the West Wind, Shelley comes off as tempestuous as the coming weather, employing an arsenal of words like fierce, dirge, tameless, black rain, fire, and hail to describe what lies ahead. Keats, on the other hand, seems much more accepting of the coming changes in his poem, To Autumn, which is generously sprinkled with more gentle imagery, the mists and fruitfulness of fall, red-breast whistles from the garden, and the twittering of swallows in the skies. The rest of us might not get as rhapsodic about changing seasons, but that doesn't mean we don't feel the changes as deeply. For me, the coming of fall always brings back good memories of going back to school, of getting new clothes, new shoes, my annual permanent, and a new lunchbox. Kids back then could shop for days, their parents willing, to get just the right lunchbox. It was an important rite of the season, and perhaps a kid's first opportunity to express his or her incipient worldview. I was delighted to recently learn that kids still are choosy about their lunchboxes. It's nice to know some things don't change. Still, there's no getting around the fact that seasonal changes remind us that we too change from month to month, year to year, that all things must someday come to an end. Our pensiveness at those times of the year, I think, must help us come to grips with the inevitability of change. It also helps to remind ourselves that every ending means a new beginning. Remember Shelley's final question to the West Wind? If winter comes, can spring be far behind?
Janet Pearson was a former op-ed writer for the Tulsa World and now a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives and listen on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.